Commissioner Ludeman, I didn't know when we invited you to this one, we didn't know you were going to be at the Legislative Commission meeting for close to an hour. Well, Commissioner Ludeman, you probably don't remember, but about a day after you got appointed to Commissioner of Human Services, you were standing next to Commissioner Mandernack at an event, and I came up and I was talking to the two of you, and I said, Commissioner Mandernack, you have the best job in the state government, and Commissioner Ludeman, you just got appointed to the worst job in state government. And it certainly has turned into a trial for you and the entire state. But if you could just give us, you know, I know you've just testified before the Legislative Commission, but if you could give us a outline of what the effects of the line item veto would be as far as GAMC is concerned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the invitation to the conferees. I will not assume that anybody heard anything in us, but I'll be as brief as I can. Obviously, last night, as people already know, that the governor did sign the conference committee report on the finance omnibus finance bill related to health and human services. It has one line item veto. It is gigantic. It is big. It is vetoing the appropriation and the appropriation only for the second year, the 2000 fiscal year 11 appropriation for general assistance medical care. That means it would be ended as far as funding, any funding, July 1st of 2010. GMC is a longstanding Minnesota public program. It is for folks under the basic GMC is for folks under 75% of poverty. It is for folks that have that as a we had a little talk about this as a profile. I don't mean to put people in a mass category. These are all individuals with lots of other problems necessarily than healthcare, but healthcare problems that are fairly well identifiable as over half of them would have chronic mental health or chemical dependency problems that have led to other disease states or problems or healthcare problems. They are fairly transient in some regards. About 16% of them are fairly stable. There's a lot of churn in this system. It's about anywhere from 31 to 35,000 Minnesotans on an average monthly enrollment enrolled in general assistance medical care. And this veto has line item veto in even albeit July 1st of 2010 has many implications. We talked about that somewhat at the Legislative Commission. One of them is trying to make an assumption about anybody that would be in GMC that could be and may be and currently are eligible for Minnesota care. It is not the entire population. Some of them could be eligible and would be eligible for Minnesota care, which is a premium-based system, which GMC has a fairly significantly different payment system. It is one that has a hospital-only component for even people up to 175% of poverty, but for the basic and most of those population is about how to provide care both retrospectively, which is the big portion of the problem with general assistance medical care, because we can't find another way to identify these folks and pre-enroll them. This is about what causes them to get through the door of GMC. It's probably a big episode. It's probably expensive. It probably 40% of them are mental health related on those first episodes, and those are retroactively paid for, not prospectively. The rest of the payment system is through managed care organizations covering and then prospectively paying capitation rates to cover the folks in general assistance medical care. Counties, we didn't talk about this much, but counties have been a partner in some of the enrollment activities related to GMC. If to the degree that if this actually ends on July 1st, we think that there's opportunity in the next 3.5 days or in the next longer period of time to find some solution to this now that this is it is law. The decision was made, and that veto is current law. That we could find solution to have the right kind of impact on Minnesota care. If people are fine transition toward a premium-based system, for most of this population, that would be a $4 a month premium. That may or may not be a good thing. It does have one effect. It changes, obviously, the funding source for how these folks would be paid for, because Minnesota Care is paid through the Health Care Access Fund. None of this is Medicaid eligible. Currently, these are adults without children at low ends of income in a different profile of health care needs. Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to think of what, talking about it all morning now, I'm trying to think of what else would be pertinent. Maybe we can discover that through questions and answers.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, what, if any, impact do you anticipate this veto will have on the Regional Treatment Center program and its budget?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, that's a very good question. Our state-operated services, including our regional treatment centers and our community-based mental health hospitals, will probably receive more pressures. Most of that is even the deeper end of services for civil commitments, even for folks with high-end mental health needs. Probably more pressure. We do have some capacity left in it. It would be probably at certainly more expense we have not yet been able to measure what the real net effect of the pressures on state-operated services would be.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, do you have capacity in your appropriation?
Commissioner. Chairman, Senator Berglund, no, not in the appropriation.
Commissioner, do you... You know, ISIS downstairs, and I know you're probably looking for it, but do you have some people here? What effect would this have on the corrections budget? Because many people coming out of prison are on GA and GA MC.
Mr. Chairman and the committee members, that question was asked. I haven't had an answer to that yet about particularly certain categories of offenders. There are actually GMC payments made for folks in short-term correction facilities, mostly county jails, for example. That is one way that their health care is paid for, and that would be at risk in this line item veto, which is a pressure either, I don't understand the entire correction system, either through the community corrections budget pressures as well, or the Department of Corrections budget as well. I do not know what that pressure would be.
And could you kind of describe the governor's original proposal that related to the uncompensated care pool when he sort of remodeled GAMC and took out the inpatient part of it?
Right. Mr. Chairman, on the retroactive portion of that, you know, about it's well understood that almost 40% of the expenditures in GMC are for is actually payments made to hospitals. What that proposal was, this is after the forecast and after the stimulus was incorporated into the forecast, the governor did make an amendment to his original budget proposal that talked about a reform of GMC, or a change in GMC, let's say it that way, that would take out the inpatient benefit of GMC coverage, take it out of managed care altogether for all GMC, make it a fee-for-service system, which is direct payments to provider or the primary care providers and clinics, add a care coordination fee to that as part of that benefit set, and then take all those hospital payments and pool them into an uncompensated care pool for a subsequent or later distribution under a distribution formula for those hospitals providing GMC and coverage.
Commissioner, could you refresh my mind? Where did the money come from for the uncompensated care pool?
That was out of the general fund, Mr. Okay. Chairman, as part of that reform. It was to affect approximately at that time $170 million in savings in GMC. but that only measured the state's effect. The effect on hospitals or any one hospital in that effect would have been more effect, of course, than the $100 million appropriate out of the general fund for that pool.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, my understanding is that carving JMC out of managed care doesn't give you any savings. My understanding is that it might actually cost us more. If that step alone were part of how you got your savings, I don't think there were any.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, actually, it wasn't the only step. It was also making the benefit set slimmer. It was a skinnier benefit set, skinny enough to not only save money, but then add some room for this care coordination fee as well. So only certain procedures, lab, and I'd have to, if you want the list of what that really meant, we'd have to rediscover a way to have you informed about that again, I think. But it was.
I don't think we ever received a list.
It was a slimmer benefit set, and then the addition of the care coordination fee, all at savings. To one degree, the simple transition from managed care to fee-for-service alone would not have affected enough savings. It is argued, and it is actually proven, that managed care organizations actually lose money in the administration of GMC as a public program. All of them do at some levels of loss for GMC.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Commissioner Ludeman, I don't believe we ever received a list of the benefits set and the savings that would have gone along with it. So
Madam Chair, I don't know if we want to try
that
now, but you will get.
No, I'm not asking you to tell us now. I'm asking if you could get that information to my office in the next hour or so.
It will be delivered.
Okay. Other questions for Commissioner Ludeman?
Mr. Speaker, if I can say one thing, sure, that I lost in the walkover, is that this whole issue and the governor's conversation and now decision about it has related to the growth, the general fund growth in the program. There's no doubt about that. This cost $555 million in the current biennium. It will cost $748 million in the next biennium with no change, and it will cost $921 million in this subsequent biennium. That first growth from first biennium to second was a 35% growth pattern biennium to biennium, and that is causing much of this conversation as well.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any calculations of how much the growth in that same population will be to our healthcare system in general if they're not in a public program? It's going to grow regardless, right? It's just a matter of which pot it's in.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, I understand that. I think that to a general degree that's true. There would be some calculation about what pressures it would create in the healthcare in Minnesota care, if to the degree that some are able to transition there, to the degree that some are uncompensated, to the some degree those don't seek healthcare, which has a subsequent higher cost. It would be, I suppose, at least approximate or cost to the system as it currently is as well.
And Mr. Chair, so that I guess I didn't really hear an answer. It's true that it's going to cost just as much to our overall health care. So these people with their medical conditions and chronic conditions will cost just as much or probably more to our overall system. I mean, the governor has this approach of dividing, and many of us here too do, of dividing our health care system between public programs and private programs, which is in reality a false dichotomy. And so the money is going to be spent one way or another, and probably more of it if they don't have at least access to some kind of care. And I know a lot of these folks don't even use the GAMC as a way of managing their conditions because it show up at that emergency room. But some do.
Correct.
And so I just want to kind of, instead of a long answer, I'd like just a kind of a short acknowledgement, if you think it's accurate, that in fact, as a state, we'll be spending as much or more on this population of people if they leave GAMC.
Commissioner.
I understand it better, Mr. Chairman and Representative Thiessen. Generally speaking, I think it would say, as an entire state, the cost would be approximately the same, public and or private.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, thinking of the profile of the people who are on GAMC right now, I know that one of the governor's priorities is are veterans. Do you know what the percentage of people who are utilizing GMC, and in this growing number are veterans, and I would guess it must be growing, and if you can tell us anything about, you know, how it has been developing.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, no, we don't know the answer on the veterans. There is no way we do know it. It's not on an application. It's not incorporated. We don't calculate that. I will be delivering to Senator Pogemiller and Senator Berglund, Representative Huntley, in an hour or so, a letter about chronic mental health, chronic chemical dependency. We'll be able to give what you call profile information about that, but the veterans would be, we do not actually have any method to calculate how many veterans who
Clark.
Have availability of services in other areas that may have fallen into and are being paid for through general assistance medical care, but we would not know that number.
I'm wondering, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, whether or not we couldn't start tracking that. I think it would be an important thing to do, and it wouldn't really require very much data gathering as part of when a patient is being served.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I understand the intent to find that information. This is a careful population. We even have some experience in Minnesota care that you would think that one more check mark doesn't matter. It actually starts to become a barrier to people that become a little more anxious about that. But we'd certainly consider it and see if that is important enough information.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of my thoughts about that is that,
Clark.
You know, some of these folks may be eligible as well for some of the veterans service medical care, and if we can somehow help make sure that they don't get left out of that by tracking that information, that would be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I think that is the only intent for us to be able to gather that information to redirect them to different kinds of services that are paid
Senator
for
Berglund.
As well.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Ludeman, what portion of the reduction would be people who would be in the transition to Minnesota care because of this veto? And then what portion of the population coming into Minnesota care would not be doing so because the transition program would be lost?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, we have those are hard numbers. It's in the couple thousand area. I'm going to ask Assistant Commissioner Osberg, if you don't mind, to help me answer.
Welcome to the Conference Committee,
yes.
Mr. Osberg.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in terms of the number of people involved, about 35,000 projected to be, on average, enrolled in GAMC in fiscal year 2011. And about 7,000 or 8,000 of those people are involved in transitional Minnesota care, and the others in regular GAMC, where they have a qualifier, as you're familiar with.
And so,
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, Assistant Commissioner Osberg, so we would then anticipate somewhere in the neighborhood of 7,000 fewer people enrolling in Minnesota care?
Mr. Osberg.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, not necessarily. They would have the opportunity, of course, to enroll into Minnesota care. They'll be eligible, in large part, for Minnesota care, but it would not be a transition, in automatic transition into from the GAMC door into Minnesota care like we have today.
Mr.
Senator
Chairman
Berglund.
And Assistant Commissioner, just to refresh your memory of how this transition program works, people leaving GMC and going into Minnesota care have a period of time where there's no premiums, they're auto-enrolled. And without GMC transition program, they wouldn't be auto-enrolling, they wouldn't be, there'd be no bridge to Minnesota care. So I think the idea that somebody in that situation would be enrolling in Minnesota care, going through the application process and paying a premium, I think that's just naive on your part to think that those folks are going to end up in Minnesota care.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, what would happen, first of all, in terms of the current GAMC clients, they would be transitioned into Minnesota care. Now, there's also availability of providers and other organizations to paying for the premium for people in Minnesota Care. That option may be picked up by certain organizations. But in terms of people then applying for JAMC, of course, they would not be doing that through the counties any longer under this arrangement. They would apply directly through Minnesota Care. And they have to go through the process that anyone else does. That is correct.
And
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, on a good day, that takes 30 days. I'm in an emergency room with a mental health breakdown. You know, my provider is worried about what to do with me right now, today, not what's going to happen to me 30 days from now.
Representative Huntley.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I have a number of questions, but on this issue, I was listening to the testimony this morning, Commissioner Ludeman, and the interchange with you and Representative Lummer, or Emmer, from the House, indicating that they thought that Senator Berglund's concerns about this population actually being able to transition and have their issues resolved in Minnesota Care. Senator Berglund had talked about that being naive just now, just terribly naive, but you were defending that was not a valid position. Would you talk more about that?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'm trying to think of the actual exchange. There's no question that it has some difficulty. What currently happens if there's this fairly significant healthcare episode, the healthcare system, particularly some safety net hospitals, don't even have the option to decide how it's going to get paid for. They're going to do it. It's going to be either uncompensated care, a retroactive payment through JMC, or nothing. I mean, or nothing. And so that's the dilemma that any of these discussions are going to have for particularly several large safety net hospitals who are at the biggest risk of a significant change in JMC. That does not mean we should stop the effort to try to move some of our safety net obligations of a state that will exist whether we want them to not or not. I understand that extremely well. Some states do not have coverage for adults without children at all, and we do and have a long history of it. But this gets into some of the funding source confusion and some of those other issues, and also a large and fast-growing budget obligation that you as state legislators are having to deal with it right now is something that we think has to be changed, and changed in a fairly significant way. The proposal to it would be at least as difficult, or maybe even more difficult, I think, than the GMC proposal that was made about this inpatient fee for service and care coordination fee and the uncompensated care pool. But there's, you know, we have not had a lot of discussion about any of these three options: keep everything the way it is and find a way to pay for it, reform or change the current GMC system, or the decision yesterday to line item veto and cause some conversation, or ultimately walking off the cliff and saying we will not have a GMC proposal at all, and we will have to work harder to transition people into Minnesota Care as fast as we possibly can.
Thank you. What I heard you say and what I heard Commissioner Osberg say is that we would count on some other system to pick up these costs other than the state, that we would be creating a system where to avoid having to pay uncompensated care. Maybe they'd pick up the premium, or maybe they'd pick up the co-pays. That's what I just heard someone say. That, again, it's a shifting to another system, the obligations of capturing and paying for something that apparently you're proposing is better paid by something other than the general fund. Because what we're talking about here is whether it's some voluntary organization or the hospitals or the Minnesota Care provider tax, which is only on a very narrow group of people, ill people, paying for the health care services for this group of people, rather than keeping it in the general fund where it has a general obligation, just so that we can pretend that somehow we are relieving the system of an obligation around health care. It's really only dealing with how can the governor move away from this session and say that he's balanced the general fund by creating all sorts of disasters throughout the system by transferring everything over to Minnesota Care. And it's still unclear to me what the issue is, what it is that you think this does to help the issue of prospective versus retro payment, and that issue that you're talking about as being a problem for us, when the population that's being supported through this particular program that's being not funded, I'm still not clear if you're eliminating the program or simply not funding it during the next biennium. But what, in fact, you are doing is creating a scenario where there are the need for crisis intervention. And so you have to go back and capture those costs because it's not anticipated. It's not futuristic. And in those situations, how are we going to be able to make whole those systems that are treating these people?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, if I may, you asked several questions.
Yes, I did. I have several more.
I'll go backwards if you don't mind. Some say I do that all the time, but it does not solve. The line item veto does nothing to solve the retroactive payment system at all. It wouldn't, if the line item veto is allowed to stay current law all the way through July of 2010, there would be no retroactive payments, fee for service or managed care or any other system for some of those first episodes that are currently the gateway into enrollment in GAMC. That is true. There are serious medical systems that would be at serious risk for the loss of payment for those services, whether they have to provide by current federal law as a hospital those services. They will be provided.
Let me just ask you, let me just make sure that I understand what you're talking about and all those significant problems that are created by that. Is that what you're talking about when you use the word pressures? I mean, you've used this term pressures like it's something sort of a soft landing concept.
No, we're
talking about significant, horrific distress that your tone and your term, pressures, sort of suggests are something we're going to be able to easily figure out.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sher, no, I guess some of us all live in a pressurized world, and the pressure can be horrific as well. But it is a business pressure. It is not a healthcare pressure. It is some healthcare pressure over time if people don't believe that they can get the care and don't find their way to find the care no matter what. That is not the point. But obviously, who pays for it? In the general, as Representative Thiessen was saying, the state, public or private, will have to pay for these services one way or the other. The system will. But it pushes, like, I guess, the old balloon story and other things. We can say, we're not going to pay for it. Somebody else will. That's what I meant by those kinds of a pressurized system. None of these proposals, even the current law, does not relieve folks of those pressures. It's changing the valves. It's changing the who's going to pay. I would tell you, though, to back up to the Minnesota Care and the $4 premium that most of this population would be obliged to pay if they were enrolled in Minnesota Care, is currently being paid by other people. Healthcare providers, in some instances, will actually pay for Minnesota Care premium now. There are counties in Minnesota that currently, for a short periods of time, will pay the $4 Minnesota Care premium. Family members will pay if they have family. Many of them do not have an identifiable family, actually currently pay a Minnesota Care premium on the behalf of the client. So it is currently current practice. I'm not saying that is the solution to get other people to pay for the premium. But we have a system that works pretty well called Minnesota Care, not particularly set for this population perfectly, but at least it drives it more toward the preventive side. We're trying to get it to be that. There would be cost, certainly it would be pressures, if I may, in the broadest sense of the word, to the healthcare access fund, because these would be groups of people moving into Minnesota Care over time or as fast as they possibly could. Whether their ability to stay there or not is sustained by other people or themselves being able to pay a premium.
Representative Huntley, the essence, besides the provider tax, is that this is for the working person who is paying a premium. Minnesota Care is a premium program. Of course, that premium is adjusted based on income. But when we're talking about this population and their ability to make a contribution through a premium of $4 to the system, is not a sustainable way to address the enormous pressure that there is on all of us to find a way to support people who need access to health care. This proposal transfers a significant burden onto a system that we've just been hearing testimony is going to be in deficit already under the current system, where people are paying in premiums, who have some higher level of income, a higher level of premium, than what we're talking about moving into it now. Simply, if I understood, I heard you confirm this, so that the governor can say that he's balancing the general fund.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, this is not actually a proposal. The governor line item vetoed a second year appropriation on a major public health care program that this legislature could decide to try to change, try to do something different, try to go somewhere else in the health care or human services area to try to do it. If you believe that to be his only motive, this certainly isn't a reform or a proposal. It is what it is. He had no other chance or no other venue to be able to deal with how this legislature or this state will balance its budget or pay its bills for the next several years. I'm not going to get into a bigger and more global budget discussion with you over that, but I just want this to be characterized for what it is. It's a simple one-line, one-X. It was not simple. It was a big deal. We talked about it a lot and about these consequences that we're talking about. It was not a small deal. It's a huge deal. It is not the best of choices. But it is not an option, as was talked about quite a bit yesterday.
Thank you, and thank you. I stand corrected about it being proposed. You're right. It has been done. It is a big deal. But I would correct that he didn't have other options. I do not agree with that. He had several other options, including taking a look at how we might be able to resolve our capacity to find revenue to support these programs in the general fund.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, I am concerned about some of the hospitals that will be affected by this veto. Of course, there are the obvious ones. We don't need to talk about them. We both know who they are. But there are other hospitals that have major impacts because of this proposal as well, and I'm not sure that they can sustain these kind of reductions. For example, North Memorial Medical Center, over $21 million. Rochester St. Mary's, over $19 million. St. Louis Park, Park Nicollet, over $7 million. North Country Health Services in Bemidji, almost $5 million. St. Joseph's Medical Center in Brainerd, almost $3 million. As you go down the sheet, the numbers get smaller, but the hospital's total revenues get smaller also. Has there been any thought or any discussion in the governor's office about what will happen to these hospitals? I'll just throw into that question the fact that the decision that Park Nicollet has made already will discontinue serving on an outpatient basis 10,000 mental health patients, 42% of which are public patients, who I have no idea where they're going to go.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, the next Commissioner Berglund, I think.
I hope so.
Senator Berglund, first of all, I would have to say that calculation is, I think, at least double. It's certainly double, approximately double of what the current payments to hospitals are. I don't want to make a big deal out of it, but that is the worst case calculation of what a hospital would have to incur, 60% beyond their current payment system through JMC, as if all current JMC population would have to walk through every emergency room door all the time for the current health care that they're being provided. I don't think that would be the net effect of JMC not existing. Current obligations or payments, for example, to anyone on that list would be 40% of the numbers that you that you just talked about, that doesn't mean it isn't a big deal to any one of those hospitals. It's still millions of dollars for many systems, hundreds of thousands of dollars for many others, even in rural Minnesota. I think at least, however, it's focusing the decision or discussion about hospitals who are already suffering, despite this legislature adopting a budget or not, who are making a lot of bad choices, not bad choices, difficult choices. They're the right choices for them to make, to get themselves right size for the kind of utilization that's even coming through their door, through the commercial insurance world, non-public program systems as well. State employees is a good example. Utilization of the healthcare system, even with that current construct of a fairly significant benefit design, utilization has went down, particularly at hospitals. And so hospitals are feeling the brunt of the market and the recession, whether this legislature signs or changes its budget or not. And so that this will be an exaggeration or an accelerator to some of the problems that hospitals have. This doesn't happen until July 1st of 2010. I have talked to several safety net hospitals already this morning that they would have to make business planning decisions that would precede July 1st, probably precede the onset of the next legislative session for them to be able to successfully size their capacity to do whatever they have to do, not just for capacity, but to make sure that they can survive on a business environment. I don't want to understate the business effect this has on Minnesota hospitals or the hospital system. It would be very, very significant. I'd say let's not let it happen.
Representative Murphy gets the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And hi, Commissioner Ludeman.
Hi.
The GMC, let me start again. In the governor's supplemental budget after federal stimulus, there was a very rudimentary frame of a proposal on GMC coming from the governor. And when you and Assistant Commissioner Osberg came to testify on that budget proposal, we asked if the department had talked much with the hospitals about how that proposal with care coordination payment would work for the hospitals. And I think at the time, Assistant Commissioner Osberg testified that you had not. And subsequent to that, we've had, you know, lots of conversations with the hospitals about that proposal, and I'm wondering if the department has, until today, pursued those conversations to understand how the rudimentary proposal that we saw in February would actually work for the care delivery system.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy. I'll get all the titles right from here
on.
That's
okay.
That's a very good question. I appreciate that. We have talked with some of the major systems as well. I would have to say, though, that the interest was much less about the care coordination environment or the primary care clinic environment and what the possibilities of that proposal would have been, and almost always expressed in concern that the uncompensated care pool was simply not large enough. And so I would have rather had the first conversation first to say, how can we deliver health care or health to this population better first, through the right door, at the right price, in at least the right environment, rather than worrying again about the first issue here is the business survivability on the current payment system on the hospital side. I would not like to be a hospital administrator or even working in a hospital. It's a tough environment. It always has been. We have 143 hospitals in Minnesota. All of them except one is nonprofit. They have a nonprofit mission that's to be admired. They do it pretty well, but they're relying on a payment structure that is fairly rigid. They're exposed on a line item budget issue, whether it be quarterly payments, dish payments. They're fairly complex with all kinds of revenue streams, and they're under stress. They didn't say they were under stress because they weren't in 2007. I appreciate that. That's fine. We want them to do well. Expansion started to be prepared, and in August of 2008, the world went to heck in a handbasket. It went to heck in a handbasket quicker on some of the utilization decisions that people make in the commercial world and even in the public program world to say that their business is less than it was. But the focus was always about the size of the uncompensated care pool, and I never got to a platform where we could have a conversation on how to make that bigger to at least offset or mitigate some of the effects of the distribution of those hospital costs. And any promise that I could make to say, well, let's double it, what do you think about it then, was not a conversation that was to be had in a legislative environment.
And Mr. Chair, and thank
Representative
you,
Murphy.
Commissioner Ludeman. I appreciate that candor. I do think that, you know, the veto sends a signal, if anything. I want to remark a little bit on the comment that you made that when you use the term pressure, you're talking about business pressure. A business pressure and not a healthcare pressure. And when I think about the GAMC population in my work at the University of Minnesota as a nurse, you know, we took care of what are unfortunately called frequent flyers. I did in Wisconsin as well. And I didn't know what GAMC was when I was practicing nursing at the U, but I know I took care of somebody eligible. He was wheelchair bound, a diabetic. He was a drug addict. He had an indwelling Hickman catheter, and he was injecting heroin in that. And he would come to the hospital on a regular basis to have parts of his body amputated because his disease was so out of control. If we think that we can move this population into Minnesota care because it's a better financing model for the state, we are closing our eyes to the difficult population and what they face. And the financial pressure on the hospitals is one measure. But I think we also have to look at the moral pressure that puts on the providers. I understand the governor wants some attention to this method, but he could have called 651-296-8799, and I would have picked up the phone. He didn't have to veto and cancel this program to get my attention. And to get the attention of the providers who are going to have to care for these people. They're sick. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. And you spent a lot of time in the legislature today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members.
Okay, next we're going to have Mike Belzer from HCMC. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Michael Belzer. I'm the medical director at Hennepin County Medical Center and have held that position for the last 20 years. Hennepin County Medical Center is the state's largest and oldest safety net hospital, continuously providing services to the uninsured and underinsured in our community and the entire state, a role that we've served for over 120 years, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify to you today regarding the impact of the governor's decision yesterday to eliminate general assistance medical care. I want to talk about it in terms of what it means for the medical center and what it means for the patients. We believe we're a pretty important community asset. We train a lot of the state's workforce. At any one time, we have 95 University of Minnesota medical students training on our campus, 300 residents, thousands of other healthcare providers in different disciplines. And over 50% of the state's MDs received part or all of their training at Hennepin County Medical Center. Training the workforce for the state's an important mission. On a warm evening in August in 2007 when the bridge fell, we were there. We were there because it's our job to be there. In the initial stages of the flu pandemic, when the community was and the world was very, very worried, we coordinated the medical regional response, and we continue to serve as the regional trauma preparedness coordination center, training the state's physicians in emergency preparedness. When a psychiatric emergency occurs after hours, when private practice psychiatrists are home and there are no beds available in the community, we have the metropolitan area's only 24/7 professionally staffed psychiatric emergency department in the metropolitan area. When a child with 90% burns to their body needs a burn center in the West Metro area, we're that facility. After a fire, if a patient has acute carbon monoxide poisoning and needs to have acute therapy at any hour of the day with hyperbaric oxygen, we're the only facility in the state. We're there. Elimination of general assistance medical care funding for the medical center is a $36 to $40 million problem for us in a 12-month period when it starts. That on top of the other state cuts we've seen with unallotment and rebasing and whatever is in the governor's bill that we haven't been able to assess yet may tally up to $50 or $60 million a year. Our budget is $550 million a year. A 10% cut would be, if sustainable, would leave us with a very, very different looking institution than the institution you've come to rely on. We'll be forced to cut valuable mission programs, a reduction in the capacity likely to take care of primary care patients, the special needs patients as well. Specialty clinical service, such as dentistry, for which there is an impossible need to provide adequate services as it is. Mental health services, diabetes services, HIV programs, oncology programs. And we'd have to consider where we draw the safety net for taking care of uninsured patients around the county or around the metro area, very different than we've been doing at present. With program reviews, which we'll need to do with a 10% or more cut, I can't guarantee that the programs I talked about initially that serve the community would survive. My colleagues and I have spent our entire professional career in healthcare, taking care of the disadvantaged, the vulnerable, and poor, and dismantling an important healthcare system for this population, the general assistance medical care population, and the spinoff, which would affect every other patient we're taking care of if we don't have the finances to continue our programs, is a terribly sad event for all of us. The poor on public programs, or the poor on programs such as general assistance medical care, earn less than $8,000 a year. They typically don't vote. They don't belong to political action committees. They're voiceless. And the decision that the governor makes and you help influence should be carefully weighed in consideration of what it means for their health. We believe that the elimination of general assistance medical care is a very bad policy and just serves to look like a large bullseye target on the back of safety net hospitals for obvious reasons and for the patients that we serve. By removing the source of insurance, these patients will not disappear. And by eliminating the cost of funding of GMC, obviously they're not magically going to get well. What will happen is they'll delay care. And when they delay care, they'll present at a sicker and a later stage of illness and seek medical care that will only be more costly, add to institutions' health care losses, and cause more programs to be cut for this very vulnerable population. We were talking about the inconvenience of who's going to pay or whether it's going to fall to Minnesota Care. Let me just say that uninsurance is not just an inconvenience about where you receive care or who pays for it. Just the mere act of being uninsured is a serious and devastating consequence for a patient. Uninsured patients have worse health status at every age. They're sicker, they die younger, and as I've mentioned before to committees, it's very clear and well documented that there's a 30 to 50% increase in mortality. And that the major estimates are that somewhere around 30,000 people die in the United States each year merely because they do not have health insurance. It's the role of government to protect its citizens, not harm them. Being poor is difficult enough without having the added burden of illness imposed upon you in the name of fiscal responsibility. My goodness, I think we could build a few fewer bridges, maybe pave five fewer freeways, or put a couple more kids in a classroom. No doubt that these are annoyances to what we think is important in the Minnesota lifestyle, but these actions don't add to the burden of ill health and death to a voiceless population that cannot defend themselves at these hearings. So I want to each of you and thank you for your attention to this issue on the behalf of the patient. And I want you to consider the serious human toll by removing the poor from health insurance by eliminating their safety net. Thank you very much.
Are there questions for Dr. Belzer? No, I guess not. Could you, what, if you had to start slimming down, what kind of facilities would you think you would, or services would you have to eliminate first?
Well, the
let me ask you another question, too,
yeah, okay,
where you can write them down. How much can right now the property taxpayers of Hennepin County pay you? About $35 million a year, it seems to me. If we have levy limits so they can't raise it. First of all, how much could they raise it, and how much if we did not have levy limits, or would they the county commissioners demand that you live within your current budget, and what services would you then eliminate?
Mr. Chair, two good questions. The way that the financing for programs for the uninsured and disadvantaged work is that hospitals typically use programs that are profitable to support programs that are not profitable. So any institution in an environment like this would need to look at its unprofitable programs first to eliminate, rather than to eliminate profitable programs just for survival purposes. We have a wide swath of unprofitable programs that we could consider eliminating. I know that we are undergoing a serious program review now at the institution level, working with our new Hennepin Health System Board. But you could well imagine that behavioral health, HIV, oncology, some of our emergency preparedness activities, I can't even begin to list the things that we would have to consider or are considering at the present time, all of which this community has come to depend upon. In terms of property tax levy, let me ask Matt Commers, are you able to answer that?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Matt Commers, Hennepin County Medical Center. I cannot give you an accurate idea regarding the limits imposed by the levy, as that's beyond the scope of my expertise. However, I do have some information for you around this issue. We currently, last year, Hennepin County Medical Center, I should explain that the medical center has a formula agreement, which is a policy of Hennepin County to subsidize the hospital for uncompensated care. That formula is based on, yes, exactly. That formula is based on payments of 85% of the Medicaid reimbursement for Hennepin County citizen or Hennepin County residents only. Last year, that was to the tune of $28 million in payments for uncompensated care, but that was only a fraction, of course, of our cost in providing that care. Nonetheless, it is a subsidy. If $36 million were added to that, which is what would occur if the cuts to GMC stand, that would result in approximately an increase of 4.4% in county taxes to Hennepin County residents. That would be approximately a little over 1%, 1.4% for total county, city, and school taxes per household increase. And I can tell you, as a Hennepin County resident myself, my property taxes have went up 10% 3 years in a row and 17% this past year alone. So we're not talking about a lot of room. I understand that that means about $58 per household per year. I hope that that's helpful to you.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, and whichever one of you could answer the question, how much of the uncompensated care burden you carry today is for residents who do not reside in Hennepin County?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, I understand that number to be approximately 20% of our uncompensated care is provided to residents of counties other than Hennepin County.
So, Mr. Chairman, 20% of what number are we talking about here?
We have Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, we have approximately $48 million in uncompensated care costs. That should be carefully distinguished from the charges, which, of course, are much higher, closer to $100 million in uncompensated care charges, but we prefer to state the cost number because it's more accurate and representative. So it's about $48 million in uncompensated care costs in 2008, and that number will be higher this year.
So, Senator Berger. Mr. Chairman, not to say that this would be a decision you would make, but you could shed about $9.6 million of that by not offering those services?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, that would be my understanding as well. I believe that's correct.
Well, let me ask. Right now you're required to treat people that have an emergency, but what percentage of those from outside the county that you could say, well, this is not an emergency, go down the street? Do you treat those people or what happens now?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps this would be an appropriate moment to defer to Dr. Belzer.
Mr. Chair, you are correct. We have a legal statutory obligation to take care of patients in the emergency department, stabilize them, or treat them regardless of the location where they reside. At the present time, we do provide care to out-of-county state residents in chronic care settings in our clinics, regardless of the county that they reside in. So we don't make that differentiation because at the present time and recently we have considered ourselves a state institution, even though we're known as Hennepin County Medical Center.
Thank you. Any further questions for Dr. Belzer? So, this is the other gentleman here.
Mr. Chairman, thanks very much. Ron Weiberg, Hennepin County Human Resources and Public Health. In addition to the implications for the Hennepin County Medical Center, any changes or reductions or elimination of GAMC is going to have an impact on the Hennepin County Adult Corrections Facility as well as the Hennepin County Jail. In 2000, between March of 07 and July of 08, at the Hennepin County Jail, we were reimbursed $298,000 from GAMC for medical services provided to recipients who were being held pretrial. At the Adult Corrections Facility, which is our post-conviction facility, we submitted 187 claims for medical services and were reimbursed $512,000. So in 08 and also in 07, we collected a little over $800,000 because of the statute that exists that GAMC recipients who are active when they are incarcerated either pre- or post-conviction can retain their GAMC eligibility. Now, we have some people that are on Minnesota care, but that's a very small piece. In 08, of the ones that we would determine to be on some type of economic assistance health care, 88% were on GAMC. Now, if GAMC were to be eliminated, as Dr. Belzer indicated, that you know the medical center has to provide health care by law. In jails, in county jails, and in county workhouses, we are required by federal law. In fact, the Supreme Court decision, Estelle versus Gamble, requires that adequate health care be provided to inmates of secure detention facilities. So a lot of the people coming in that are on GAMC, we can get them stabilized, and when they're released from the adult corrections facility or released from jail, they can still get medication. If we don't have GAMC, they're going to come into our facilities. We'll stabilize them. It'll have to be at local tax dollar expense. But what happens when they get out? There is no follow-up. likely, especially those with a mental illness, and that's getting to be a larger and larger portion of the population of jails all over this country. If there's a mental health problem, we get them stabilized in the facility, and they get out, and they can't get their prescriptions refilled, we're going to see them again, and again, and again, and again. This is not a good way to handle this situation. So I just wanted to add the impact for Hennepin County's correctional programs, in addition to the multi-million dollar hit that the medical center is going to take if this GAMC program is eliminated. I heard Representative Clark mention something earlier about veterans' benefits. It is possible, and I think it's kind of an untapped source right now that needs to be looked at a little more closely. In Hennepin County, I'm actually assigned to the Vet Services Office, and we're developing a program called the Veterans Futures Program, which is dealing with veterans in the criminal justice system. And what we're trying to do, and we're doing with some degree of success, is getting some of these folks qualified for federal veterans benefits so that they can get treated through the VA medical system. A lot of the people that were sitting in jails today, and we got about 85 sitting in prison that are military veterans, a very, very, very high percentage of those are because of post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's best to treat that in a veteran facility. So it's something that I think needs to be talked about over the interim is what can the state of Minnesota, what can counties throughout the state of Minnesota do to better utilize federal veterans' benefits for veterans that are in the criminal justice system. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you for your testimony. And we're going to have Anna Meyer from Criminal Justice Project.
I'm Anna Meyer from NAMI, Minnesota.
Okay.
Sorry, that wasn't listed on there.
I understand you're in a hurry.
Mr. Chair, my name's Anna Meyer. I'm a project director at NAMI, Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. NAMI, Minnesota is a statewide grassroots organization dedicated to improving the lives of people with mental illnesses and their family members. Sue Abderholden apologizes she could not be here today to testify. NAMI, Minnesota strongly opposes any cuts to GAMC. In bad economic times, we all need to sacrifice, not just those who are the sickest and poorest among us. For people on GAMC for 27 months or more, 65% have a mental illness or a co-occurring disorder of a mental illness and chemical dependency. For those on GAMC less than 27 months, it's 49%. These Minnesotans use GAMC and GA to access mental health treatment, prescriptions, and other services while they're waiting to qualify for Social Security and MA. Many people go into the emergency room with their first psychiatric episode, and they're uninsured. GAMC can cover these individuals while they're waiting to get federal benefits. Because the wait to qualify for SSI and MA can be as long as 2 years, GAMC provides a really important function. Also, in the governor's letter to the speaker yesterday, he said that many people who will lose GAMC may qualify for Minnesota Care. However, Minnesota Care is not the same as GAMC, as many of you know. It's not an entitlement program. It has premiums and co-payments. But to qualify for GAMC, you have to have less than $1,000 in assets to your name and earn less than $650 a month in income. So Minnesota Care is not a viable option for many of these individuals. We'll have nowhere else to turn if they lose GAMC for mental health treatment. People will delay treatment, and they'll not be able to gain to afford their medications, and they'll end up in higher cost crisis services or in jails. And as Mr. Weiberg said, they'll go in and out and in and out. So thank you for bringing attention to this issue.
Any questions?
Thank
the
you.
Senate obviously got called out.
Then I have no questions.
So thank you for your testimony then. And Dr. Belzer still here? Representative Thiessen has a question for you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen.
Yeah, and I'm sorry we got called the call of the House while you were testifying, so I had to go up and vote. So I apologize for having to call you back up. But I understand there was some testimony about $58 a year in property taxes having to be raised perhaps to cover this the loss. Is that right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. And I guess my question is to kind of just get it down. If the cuts to the hospital amount what you anticipate a closure of GAMC would be and what we're seeing on some of the documents here, what does that mean in terms of keeping, and especially if we consider levy limits which remain in place, what does that mean for whether HCMC stays open? I mean, would you have to consider the option of closing the hospital?
Well, I don't.
Dr. Belzer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen. I don't want to ring the alarm bell at a meeting like this without the authority of our board of directors, but let me just say that if the cuts were in the range that the Minnesota Medical Association, I mean the Minnesota Hospital Association circulated, which is a worst-case scenario with no coverage and individuals receiving care in the emergency department of well over $100 million, I would have a difficult time understanding how we could sustain those cuts and continue to be an all-service acute care hospital. On the lower end, as previously mentioned, we're going to have to take a serious look and are taking a serious look at programs that are designed to take care of the disadvantaged and vulnerable now, and there's a whole swath of those that are important community programs for citizens of the city and the state in terms of what we do in a variety of areas for specialty care, HIV care, oncology care, diabetes care, primary care, and I'm not sure exactly what else we'd have to do. We are looking at program review. We're going program by program. And as mentioned before, what the strategy would be to eliminate programs that are not profitable, and those are typically programs that are designed to take care of this population.
And so, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, so just, you know, I know that if the worst-case scenario comes to fruition, it's over $100 million as a share. I know you don't want to say you can't make a definitive statement, but one of the options on the table and a very real option would be closing down HCMC as we know it as a full service kind of hospital.
That would be, I wouldn't say it's a strong possibility, but as you carve out things to meet a 20% budget cut. You know, hospitals like ours run on razor-thin margins anyway, and on good years, a 1% margin would be a good year. We're constantly weighing programs versus revenue. If we had an overlay of a 20% budget cut, we would not look like Hennepin County Medical Center, and I'm not sure what would resolve or evolve out of that decision. Probably a small number of programs that were not duplicated in the community, and we'd have to figure out how that would work.
Thank you.
It'd be a serious event.
Dr. Belzer, you said that about half the docs in the state got some of their training at Hennepin County. I can tell you on a very unscientific survey in my part of the state, it'd be more like 75%. How would these cuts affect your ability to provide the medical education that you do right now?
Oh, it'd be a serious problem, Mr. Chairman. If you eliminate a program, you wouldn't have the faculty to train the residents in that particular program. So that, along with the fact that medical education, which also has seen funding cuts, would be one of the programs we'd seriously have to consider paring back to a great degree. So if you got rid of a program, for example, in internal medicine, neurology, or surgery, we wouldn't be able to train residents in that program, and we wouldn't be able to help produce trainees for the state. So it would have a very serious effect on graduate medical education training.
Thank you, Dr. Belzer. Next, we're going to have folks from Regions Hospital, Brock Nelson, Heidi Conrad, and Karen Quaday.
Thank you.
welcome to the committee. And would you please state your name when you start talking for the tape?
Mr. Chairman and members of the conference committee, my name is Brock Nelson. I'm the president and CEO of Regents Hospital. To my left is our chief financial officer, Heidi Conrad. To my right is our past chief of staff, chair of our quality committee, and an ER physician at Regents Care and Quad A. The impact to patients on GMAC will be devastating to Regents. It's a population that absolutely needs care and seeks our services. Many of the recipients have mental illness, many are homeless, many show up in our emergency room, many have chronic conditions. Removing the benefits for this population will result in a worsening of health and for many a loss of life. The impact on Regents will be devastating. We see a disproportionate share of GMAC enrollees. These patients will continue to come. They'll continue to be in our ER, they'll continue to seek care. The loss of revenue from elimination of this program in the calendar year 2010, we estimate to be $35 million. In the calendar year 2011, we estimate to be $65 million. We cannot absorb these cuts. There'll be job losses. There'll be program losses. We will close our borders. We plan to make our budget for 2010. We'll have to plan in that budget the $35 million loss that we estimate. The elimination is delayed, but the impact will be felt soon. The impact on the patients will even be more devastating. The example of a reduction in mental health programs will affect all of our population. Those who have means, the program will not be available. It will not just be impact the GMAC patients. Programs and other services, whether it's trauma, whether it's obstetrics, whether it's our clinics, patients of all means will be affected because we'll have to make cuts because of the reductions in GMAC. We have to solve this problem. We hope and request that the legislature and the governor can come to an agreement before Monday so we get this fixed. I'd like to ask Karen, Dr. Quadi, to make some comments from a provider perspective.
Hi, I'm Dr.
Welcome
Karen.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Karen Quadi. I really appreciate what Ms. Murphy said because that really is touching. I work in the emergency room at Regents, and I think what I want to do is put a face on these people. I worked last night. We had patients waiting in the emergency department for beds upstairs because they needed a private room because they had infections. There's a lot of infections that require people to have private rooms. You see building going up, and you think, oh, they have a lot of money. Well, we can't provide services if we have to close down beds to provide isolation for patients. So patients are waiting in emergency departments now because of circumstances already. So the building has to go on. But what you really need to know is the cuts that are being proposed, already there are patients out there who are suffering in their health care. Last week I had a single woman come to the emergency department. She had ignored her dental problems for a long period of time. She worked at a local pharmacy in a cosmetic section. She was a single mother, lived in a studio apartment, basically hand to mouth. Her dental problems got so severe, she ended up with an abscess the size of a small plum on her jaw and started closing off her airway. She could hardly speak, she couldn't swallow, and she was having trouble breathing. When I told her I did not have a pill that would make this go away, that she needed to have emergency surgery in the next 2 hours, I almost thought she was going to turn blue, sobbing in just frustration. Her health care crisis was, I'm going to lose my job. Who's going to watch my daughter? I won't be able to make the rent payment. I had to call her boss and swear that he wouldn't fire her. I had people in the department gathered money together and gave her money so that she had some cash for her rent payment. We made arrangements for her daughter to be picked up from the school bus. I want you to hear that right now, every day in all hospitals and all clinics, physicians, nurses, clerks, techs are reaching into their pocket and giving what they can give to help people out there in the community who are having crises in their personal lives due to health care. If you cut, that's just going to get so much worse. And I can't keep reaching into our pockets and coming up with ways to help these people. In addition, you asked a question, sir, about, well, what do you do if you decide they don't have an emergency? Well, I had a patient about 2 or 3 months ago who came in with a goiter, an enormous goiter on her neck. She had been to 5 previous medical institutions in the 2 months before she came to the ER. She knew what she had wasn't truly an emergency, but she had lost 30 to 40 pounds. Her hair was falling out. She had no energy. She couldn't sleep. And each place said, yes, you need to have something done for your thyroid. Yes, you need to take medications. She worked as a waitress. She lived in an apartment with somebody else who worked. She couldn't afford the medication. She couldn't afford to see the clinic. She's now in her 6th facility in tears because she's sick, in tears because she has all these medical bills she can't pay, and she isn't getting any better. We provided her literally the meds on the spot for a month. We got an appointment the next day with an endocrinologist who said he wouldn't charge her. He was going to make arrangements for her to get the radiation she needed for a goiter. This work happens all over the place now without the budget cuts. With these budget cuts, what are we going to do? I worked in the inner city of Detroit back in the 80s. Unemployment was 25 to 30%. There were no social programs. There were no homeless shelters. The emergency department average rate at Henry Ford Hospital was about 6 hours. I saw a patient who almost bled to death in the ER in the corner who waited 8 hours to be seen with a gunshot wound. That's what not having social programs out there in the community could do. We're not talking a crisis. We're talking devastation for individuals, for the community. We can't provide the services now adequately without people stepping up to the plate. We had a gentleman who was homeless, mentally ill, who struggles to, you know, find something in his life, to find his way in the world. And he had this winter gotten severe frostbite of his feet. He went to a local hospital. They said, yes, you have severe frostbite. Doesn't absolutely have to be admitted. Stay off your feet and take some medicines. Now, I don't know if you know about the homeless shelters, but you are out in the daytime for the most part. There's a couple exceptions. But so he went out into the world in January weather with frostbitten feet and comes to see me about 4 days later, and now we're amputating. Had he come to see us before, we at least have vouchers we provide to patients for the Economy Inn down the street so that they can get their feet up and stay warm for a few days. 2 days in the Economy Inn might have had him keep his feet. I don't know. My point is that there are a lot of people stepping up to the plate, helping to fill the gaps we already have for these patients. More of these patients is not going to be sustainable, and it's going to overwhelm the healthcare system. And if one person dies because they're waiting in the corner with a gunshot wound on the leg, it will not seem good at all. It will just, it's heart-wrenching. So I guess my only request is that you try to be a hero here and step up and sort of advocate for the people who are not capable of advocating for themselves. They're stretched already in their lives trying to make ends meet, go to work, and a little bit of a healthcare crisis for them becomes a major life crisis. And okay, I'm rambling. I'll let go.
let me ask Representative Thiessen's question. When people come into your emergency room, you don't treat them any differently if they have insurance or don't have insurance, do you?
In fact, I can't even tell you if any of the people I mentioned have any insurance. They may have some, they may not. I don't. Actually, it's an interesting thing because people often think we look at that and we don't. I try to give the most cost-efficient care I can. That includes prescriptions. We do provide medications for patients. We try very hard to keep that in mind. In addition, and this is true at Regions, but it may be true everywhere, there's a lot of effort being put on physicians to think about how they're ordering. So our electronic medical record, we are working to get sort of a cost on each order. So when you order something, you can say, oh, look at that, look what it costs, maybe I really don't need that. And also flag, if you've had that same test done recently, is it necessary to do again to sort of eliminate waste? So there's a lot of efforts being done to do that, to help contain that. But no, in general, I don't look because it doesn't really change what I do.
So just to follow up, that means that two people come in with the same problem. One has insurance, one doesn't have insurance, and there's a five-hour wait. They each wait 5 hours.
The wait is determined by how sick they are, but you're absolutely right. Hopefully they won't wait 5 hours.
And if they're mentally ill and there's no mental health beds, they both wait in the hallway?
They both wait. Some places will accept patients from us and some won't. But if we have a bed, they go to whoever's next to get a bed. Doesn't matter which one's paying and which one isn't.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, first of all, the question I asked before to Hennepin County as well about where region, what happens to regions with a cut? What is the number 46 on the sheet that the hospitals gave us? 46 million. What does that do to your viability as a hospital? Kind of 46 million on an ongoing basis.
It puts it at risk. We will have to change who we are substantially. We will not end up providing the range of services we currently provide. It will devastate us.
Okay. And then I guess just a comment, and you know, we've had what, 3 days of hearings like this and more. You know, I think that the proposal that the governor has put on the table, you know, for whatever reason, and I like the way that Representative Murphy had put this, really is, you know, I think it raises moral questions for us. But I don't think it's just about this proposal either. I mean, because we've been talking for 3 years now, and maybe longer, about how we have to reform the system, how we have to take money out of the system, how we have to reduce healthcare costs. And so in some sense, I think at least as institutions, if not as individuals, every single person in this room bears some responsibility for how we got here. And the story, when you hear stories like of the people who come into the emergency room who don't have a voice, you know, clearly this system needs to be fundamentally changed. And there's everybody sitting in this room for ideological reasons or for financial reasons or for whatever reasons has been resisting the real changes that we have to make. And it's even bigger than healthcare system. You know, we kind of talk just about the healthcare system on its own. I mean, at the end of the day, this is really an issue of income inequality in our society and class divisions in our society that we need to kind of break through here. And so I guess, you know, and I got to go to a different conference committee, but as we sit through and hear more of this discussion, we really need to keep that piece of it in mind. And I think we ought to take this, you know, the governor and the House Republicans have put this, and the House and the Senate Republicans have put this on the table as their position. And, you know, I think they should take responsibility for this position. I think that there's no question about that. But as we move forward here, we really need to all take this challenge to heart and actually figure out what we're going to give up as systems. I mean, hospitals are going to be making less money, and they have to redesign themselves. Yeah. And but we don't do it with the blunt instrument that Governor Plenty and, you know, Representative Abler and everybody who kind of brought this proposal to the table does it. I think we need to look at this in a different way. But I think we should all take this, you know, the health plans and the hospitals and the legislature and everybody else has to take this as a moral challenge to figure this out. And now I'm going to go to conference committee.
Mr.
Nelson.
We agree, and the issue is one of equity in that the burden for this problem is being placed upon Hennepin County and regions and those who serve the most needy. And we have to find a solution, but it's one issue that is around equity.
Let me ask before we go to the Ms. Conrad, but do you think that this population that is eligible for GAMC is, you know, sure, everybody ought to have a healthcare home and they ought to have a primary care doc, but is this population amenable? And that's what the governor had proposed, that we shift the focus upstream, which I'm a big supporter of, but I just don't think this population is likely to be affected much by that. If you have any comments on that.
No, I don't.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And to that point, because you and I have been talking about that some, and when I think about GAMC and the exercise we're going through right now, it is about money. When I think about GAMC and the population, I do think that we could probably do a much better job of providing care for them but it requires some of the things that Representative Thiessen was talking about. I think it requires stable housing. It requires a discussion about class. And then I think it requires really robust, more robust care coordination than we've imagined in a healthcare home to reach to these people and help them with their really chronic conditions. And so as I have thought that through, and I'm intrigued by that question, I know that it's not a venture that is going to necessarily save us money in the budget, because we're going to have to invest much more in the things that we're not investing in. I mean, we did in the conference report, in the bill that was signed, $3 million into stable housing. Good, because that's a foundation on which we can build. But I think if we're really going to try and do a better job to serve this population, we have to look at a broader set of issues than just a care coordination fee. That's just not significant enough to get the job done.
Ms. Conrad, did you have some comment? How does Ramsey County subsidize Regions? I know there's some money that goes there.
Mm-hmm. We receive a voluntary contribution from Ramsey County. It was about a little over $1 million in 2008. We appreciate very much their partnership. We work very closely together to serve the population of that community.
And does Regions treat people that aren't from Ramsey County?
Yes, about half of our charity care or uncompensated care patients come from outside of Ramsey County.
My wife's been there twice, I must say.
Our charity care, the cost of our charity care services in 2008 were $18.9 million, and about half of that was for Ramsey County patients. The rest were outside of that community.
Thank you. Thank you very much
thank
for your
you
testimony.
Very much.
And next we're going to Lori Stee. Hi, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Lori Stee, and I'm the program director for an organization called Rebuild Resources. We hire men and women in recovery from drug and alcohol addiction, and most of the people we hire have felony convictions. The first thing I want you to know is that many of those voiceless people are perfectly capable of speaking for themselves. And had I had a little more time, I would have been able to bring one or two or three of them, but they are at our facility, and they are indispensable in the work they are doing for us. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about, briefly, what we do, and then I want to share a couple stories with you of people who couldn't be here because we needed them to be elsewhere. Rebuild Resources is one of many of nonprofit social enterprises that serve men and women in our community who are struggling with poverty, with low literacy in education, and in our case with addictions and reentry issues. What we do is we hire people for up to 6 months and then help them during that time to get back on their feet, to find permanent employment, and to stabilize themselves. So I like the metaphor that was introduced earlier of a bridge. We think of ourselves very much as that bridge from, you know, one side to another, from the past to the future, if you will. And so I want to tell you two stories, and I'm going to use that metaphor to shape the way that I tell them. The first one is there's a young woman working for us who came to us through out of Shakopee Prison. She went into a private halfway house when she was released, and she very much needed to have psychiatric drugs to stabilize. She had a chemical imbalance, and it significantly affected her ability to perform ordinary daily tasks. Now, she was able to access GAMC, and So she got the meds she needed, and she continued to progress in our program to get stronger and more stable. And we've now hired her as a permanent staff member at our organization. She's one of our lead embroiderers. We produce custom apparel. And we cover her insurance. So, you know, just that little time that it took for her to get from there to here made all the difference for her. So she got to cross the bridge. Now, if we're gonna knock down the bridge, or if we're gonna decide that you know hundreds or thousands of people are not allowed on the bridge, then what are we gonna do? Are we gonna throw them in the river? Not all the people in the river will drown, but many of them do. And not all the people on the bridge are going to live happily ever after, but many of them do. Now, I remember a couple years ago, a gentleman came to us, and he was really rough around the edges. His name was Ricky, and he had several felonies, and he was a character to work with. But he got with the program, and he started working really hard at changing his life. And he came into my office one day, and he told me, you know, I said, Ricky, you look, you know, what's going on? What's up with you? And he looked kind of ashen. And he said, I don't feel good. I've got pain in my chest and my arm. And I said, how long has this been going on? And he said, well, quite a while, but really bad for the last couple days. And I said, have you gone to the doctor? And he said, I don't have any insurance. I don't qualify. Now, I can't recall details, and since I wasn't prepared to come here, I apologize for that. But I remembered, you know, I looked him right in the eye, and I said, you have to go to the hospital now. And he got up, and we got him over to the hospital, and the short of the story is that he was very ill. He had a heart condition. He ended up, he had cancer, and he was gravely ill. And we did, as a you know, a society, we did deal with Ricky on that end of it, at the end of his life, in emergency situation, in the most perhaps expensive of all possible ways. We dealt with him. Now, I don't know that the outcome would have been significantly different for him had he had care. I believe that his condition could have been managed better. But we have many people that work for us that go on to other employment, other jobs, and on in their lives who will be stabilized, who need that care for the short period of time to get them from, as I said, the past to the future. And so my primary purpose in coming here today is not to make any argument at all, except to remember those people and think about, if not morally, just think about what makes sense fiscally, because we will deal with this group of people in one way or the other. So what's going to make the most sense? And with that, I thank you for your time.
Any questions for Ms. Stee? Sini, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
For your testimony. Now I think we have, is Lisa Fink brought some people with her?
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maureen O'Connell, and I'm with Legal Aid. And today I have Rolanda Mason from our St. Cloud office and
Monica Nilsson from St. Stephen's Human Services with two others.
As you can see, we're a little disorganized. But I think we'll start briefly.
You've come to the right place.
We'll start briefly with Rolanda, and then we'll move to Melinda, and then I will make room for the gentleman to join the table.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rolanda Mason. I'm an attorney at St. Cloud Area Legal Services, where I represent low-income people in central Minnesota. I specifically work with people who are recipients of public assistance programs, including GAMC. And I've listened today to the testimony that's been presented, and we've talked about the devastating effects that the elimination of GAMC would have on our health care providers' ability to provide care, not only for this vulnerable population, but also for others who would be impacted by the reduction in services. But I want to focus today on the impact on the individuals who are eligible and currently receive GAMC benefits and what would happen to them if this program were to be eliminated, and also to talk about the greater impact that would have on our communities. And I want to tell you a couple of short stories about some specific individuals, like Frank, who lives in suburban Hennepin County. Frank has been diagnosed with chronic lymphatic leukemia. He was diagnosed in 2003, and since then he's been in and out of remission several times. Because of GAMC, he's been able to maintain health care coverage. He's gotten treatment for his leukemia. He sees a cancer doctor regularly, and right now his cancer is under control to the point that he is able to be employed. He works 15 to 18 hours a week. He earns minimum wage, but he is employed, and he's able to meet most of his basic needs. GAMC allows him to get the medical care that he needs to maintain that employment. Without that, he would not be able to be employed, and he would be looking to other cash assistance programs to meet his most basic needs. His story's not unique. There's Bob from Isanti County, who has a chronic condition that was under pretty good control when he had a job that provided health insurance, but when that job was downsized and he lost his insurance, he wasn't able to see a doctor and his condition deteriorated. It deteriorated to the point that even though he'd found a subsequent job that didn't offer insurance, he was forced to leave that job. He went without medical care and therefore suffered medical neglect for a period of time until somebody told him about the GAMC program. He got on GAMC, and he was able to get the care that he needed. He's now had one surgery as a result of the medical neglect that he suffered, but his doctors are telling him that he should be able to go back to work by the end of the year. Again, another person who is able to move forward in their life because of GAMC and the medical care that it allows them to obtain, but who without it would be facing a future of disability and limited economic options. There are also those people who are disabled and who are not going to be able to go to work and who need GAMC as a way to establish their disability. As you all are aware, disability benefits oftentimes take a couple of years to go through the Social Security Administration process. During that time, it's extremely important that an applicant be able to get medical care to support their disability claim. Because they haven't been determined disabled, they're not eligible for federal Medicaid money through the Medical Assistance Program. It is GAMC which provides the medical care coverage that allows them to gain the medical records to support their application for disability benefits. And without that, they would not be able to establish their disability, even though their conditions are such that they're not going to be able to work. If GAMC were to disappear, obviously these people would not be able to pursue their general their disability claims. But it's also important, I think, to recognize the effect that would have on our state budget from a medical standpoint. We've heard testimony here today that even without these programs, people are going to seek the doctor and that there will be funds spent from our economy in some form or fashion. But because we currently use GAMC as a way to provide medical care for these people, the state is able to get federal reimbursement for their care. Currently, under the Medicaid program, if the state provides health insurance benefits to people who are subsequently found to be disabled, the state can go back and request retroactive coverage reimbursement for the money that we've spent on their medical care during the prior 2 years. If GAMC were eliminated, we would be cutting off our ability to access this stream of reimbursement for medical costs. The effects on the individuals who receive GAMC are great, and the subsequent effects on our society would be great. I certainly urge you to do everything in your power to preserve this program. It's a necessary program for thousands of Minnesotans and numerous people that I work with every day.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Sam Joyner. I'm a lifelong resident of Minnesota, and I grew up here in the city of St. Paul. I'm from the West 7th Street area, and I'm a graduate of Monroe High School. Like most Minnesotans, I did work most of my life. I paid my taxes, and I pursued my dreams. I was always pretty much self-sufficient. Some years ago, a set of circumstances put me in a homeless situation. And I'll tell you now, it wasn't pleasant. It also had nothing to do with drugs or alcohol because I don't use either. At the present time, I have my own apartment and I've had it for 3 years. And this has been possible because I get $203 from general assistance and I have general assistance medical care. For the last 2 years, I've suffered with an ailment called DDD, degenerative disc disease. And I can tell you that on a bad day, I could hardly get out of bed. And on a good day, I could do just menial things around my apartment. General assistance medical care paid for all of my pain pills, my doctor visits, and my tests. Without it, I don't know what I would have done. I probably would have been in and out of emergency rooms like crazy. Same thing as far as my future. Right now, if I lose this medical care, it's the only way I would know to get medical care is go to the emergency room. I guess time and again it's been proven that that ends up in the long run to be more costly than just, you know, keeping the program. I have some pretty strong feelings about this. I think we're a civilized society, and I, not just for myself, but I know a lot of people that this would cause a lot of misery for. They wouldn't have any way to get any medical care except to go to the emergency room. I think that Minnesotans are willing to pay higher taxes for services. I think, my experience in the past in this state, and I've heard former governors say that they were willing to pay higher taxes for better services. I think that's still true, and I think we should be an example to the nation and care about our people. A lot of stuff we're talking about here is kind of sad stuff. You know, we've heard a lot of stuff about people that were sick and had ailments, and this is a real serious issue, but I'd like to just, before I close, talk about an experience that I had in February when I was down here. I mentioned this ailment I've had with my back has made my life miserable for 2 years. I had every medical test you can think of to try to solve the problem. Well, I came down here and spoke just like I am right now, and this gentleman who keeps running away, Republican Jim Abler, happens to be a chiropractic doctor, stopped me in the hall and asked me to come in his office. He noticed that my right shoulder was lower than my left shoulder. He heard what I had said in here, and he says, go find yourself a good chiropractor. I believe he could help you.
There he is.
Well, Representative Jim Abler lived in Anoka, and so he was honest with me. He said, find yourself any good chiropractor. He gave me some interesting tests, put books under my foot and did different things. Well, I was still pretty skeptical about doing it, but then this lady sitting next to me says, what do you got to lose? So now that you're here, I did go to a chiropractor, and I got to tell you that the first time he cracked my back, the pain disappeared, and I could walk again. I can do jumping jacks now. I could do all that stuff. It's not completely gone, but I'll tell you what, I have hope, at least got hope of working again. And that was paid for with general assistance medical care. They paid for my chiropractic. And I think about the possibility of working again. So I would just leave you with this one question. There's probably a lot of other people out there like me, too, that are counting on this and looking for an opportunity. So are you really going to take away our medical care? Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and other committee members. My name is Robert.
I am too one of those people. I've been a lifelong resident of Minnesota as well. I was a successful businessman up in Duluth. I owned a couple of businesses. And due to a couple of situations, I had a medical problem that caused me two surgeries, and I also had some serious business problems that happened, causing me severe financial distress. An opportunity came up for me to move my family down to the Twin Cities. I bought a home in Minnetonka and proceeded to work extremely hard to keep afloat with my financial difficulties. Even the inevitable happened. I ended up having to file bankruptcy and file for foreclosure. And what happened after that was we lost our home. My wife and I and my minor child, we were, I don't want to get into the details, but it was an extremely difficult time. We went from being homeowners in Minnetonka, I've never been in a situation. I've always been able to take care of myself. I've got a degree. But we ended up homeless and penniless in one morning. And that was really a shock, to say the least. We were flabbergasted, my son, my wife, and myself. That day, my wife and I looked at each other, and we just were pretty happy. We died. I mean, inside I died, as did my wife. You know, to deal with the pain, I did slide into addiction, which, you know, subsequently I've been able to pull myself out of. I've been sober for 3.5 years, which none of which would have been possible without GMAC, or GAMC, sorry. You know, and I'm a recipient of GA and GAMC, and I'm living on $203 a month, out of which I pay my rent, and I pay medical co-pays of up to $53 a month. And that's okay, because regardless, I'm very involved in my community. I sit on a couple of boards in my civilly, my neighborhood. I'm also very active and involved in a couple of boards in my church. You know, if GAMC was eliminated, my medical issues, which sleep apnea among others, would be exacerbated to the point where I would have no other alternative but to go to the emergency room, which would end up costing an incredible amount more money at doing that way than by providing GAMC. I'm asking every committee member here to fight for GAMC. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Monica Nilsson, and I am Director of Street Outreach at St. Stephen's Human Services in Minneapolis. I work with people who don't have shelter or housing. Some of those on GAMC I work with sleep behind the PetSmart in Plymouth, sleep in a porta potty in a metro park, or under a bridge at 394. According to Metro Transit, there are about 50 people riding the bus each night for shelter. Folks I work with have a difficult time managing their health, especially managing chronic disease. Fortunately, asthma or high blood pressure can be better cared for with GAMC. I'm not taking them to various emergency rooms each week for primary care. I see the return on investment. I'd like to share a short letter from a GAMC client who couldn't be here. My name is Kayla Pearson. I live in housing for persons with disabilities. Sam and Robert are my friends and neighbors, and if I could be here myself today, I would be, but unfortunately I couldn't with short notice. I suffer from bipolar disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder and anger issues. And at times, the hatred and anger I hold towards myself is so overwhelming, I harm myself by cutting my wrists, pulling out my hair, punching myself in the head, and burning myself. The medications which I take to calm some of these behaviors is simply not enough. I must also be in therapy. This fall, I am supposed to start a new therapy program called Directorial Behavioral Therapy, a program which teaches people like me how to live with their disease and still function by teaching us new alternatives in which to suppress these outbursts and live a healthy life. Every day that I think of killing myself,
I know that without GAMC to help me, I do not want to die. If you cut off our medical, I feel I will die. Please help me to live. As people I work with who are asking me if they're going to lose their medical care, my comment to them is the same as I will say to you. These are dark days, but I believe there doesn't have to be suffering. The veterans outside tell me that the warrior ethos is to leave no soldier behind. They need to believe that their protectors, you and me, won't just wait until they die or move away. No one should be left behind. Thank you for your fighting for those folks.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you for your testimony. Fairview Medical Center, Gordon Alexander and Kathy Toronto. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Gordy Alexander, president of the University of Minnesota Medical Center, physician of 30 years, and leader of the medical center for 11. University of Minnesota Medical Center is part of Fairview Health Services, which is the largest provider of Medicaid services in the state. I'm here to express, as others, my deep concern about the decision to eliminate funding for GAMC and the residual impact of that unfortunate decision that we'll have on our patients, their services, and our organization. I'm going to briefly touch on the financial impact of the loss of GAMC, but I'll ask my colleague Kathy Toronto first to share her perspective.
Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Toronto. I'm a registered nurse, and although I'm my title is president of the University of Minnesota AMPLATS Children's Hospital, I have accountability for nursing at the University of Minnesota Medical Center. I've been a nurse for over 40 years, and much of that time I've been involved with behavioral services. And I strongly am concerned about the discussions that I've heard today and the potential loss for GAMC. Fairview is the largest provider of behavioral health services in the state. At the University of Minnesota Medical Center alone, we have over 300 behavioral beds. Last year, we had 7,000 plus inpatient behavioral admissions. So we're passionate. We have had a long history of serving behavioral, and we have dedicated staff who work very, very hard with the persistently mentally ill and the severely chemically dependent. People who are covered by GAMC come to us for, they sort of utilize all of our services, but we really do serve a very high percentage of those who come for the behavioral services. We feel strongly, and as you've heard, the people who seek services who are covered by GAMC are the most vulnerable population in the state. A single person needs to have an income of less than $8,000 annually to be eligible. And to me, that in itself is a basic definition of a safety net for those individuals. So people have talked a lot about what happens if this goes away. These people will not be able to afford private premiums. I know people talk about $4. That may not sound like much, but if you have nothing, it's very hard to even scrape that together. So as people have made a very, very good point of emphasizing, they will come to the emergency rooms, or they will try to go to the few remaining free clinics that are available. They will have poor management of their current conditions. They will be much sicker when they seek care. It will drive up hospital cost, it will drive up costs to the public at large. So in short, I believe that the loss of GAMC will be detrimental to patients' health, and it's just a huge step in the wrong direction for public policy.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, as Senator Berglund discussed, we're one of the obvious hospitals between Regions and Hennepin County and University of Minnesota Medical Center. We probably cover nearly 50% of the safety net patients in the state. This is huge. The loss of $12 million at a very conservative estimate. I know the range has been large, but as Commissioner Ludeman wondered about the conservative estimate for Fairview alone, that's $12 million plus $7.2 million of matching funds. This $20 million to $40 million is huge. But let's just settle on 20. There's no way we can absorb that. We're a large organization, and we do a lot of training. And this impact will just start unraveling what we've managed to piece together. Over the last year, we cut a large amount of costs out of our system. In order to not start unraveling the system, we are providing the same level of care with $30 million less costs. We just don't think we can keep doing that. We know we have to make ongoing investments in our facilities. The patients that are want to do harm to themselves, we have to rebuild our facilities to keep them from doing so. So can we, on top of last year's 500 jobs that are decreased, absorb an additional $20 to $30 million of cuts? I don't think so. We will have to cut programs. And as was discussed before, in order to make the cuts as least impactful to our society, we will start with the programs like in behavioral that have the lowest cost or lowest profit margins, or in this case last year we lost $7 million on behavioral. There is just no easy way. Our unique mission of providing top quality care while being the largest teaching hospital in the state will have to be reevaluated. We train for 350 residents and fellows, hundreds of students, nurses, physical therapists, clinical laboratory professionals, pharmacists. As we remodel our healthcare system, as was mentioned, this blunt instrument of this cut will cause incredible harm. I think that I've got other statements, and I'm sure you're tired of hearing things over and over. This is just bad policy, in my opinion, and I think in yours. And we need to figure out a solution that doesn't impact those with the softest voices. So thank you.
This is maybe a little bit off the track, but as long as you're here.
Sure.
Does Fairview or any other hospitals that have residency programs, is it profitable for them to have, say, a surgery residency versus a family practice or psychiatry? I don't think they make money on.
Well, it's hard to separate it out. Having teaching programs is not profitable. The cost, we did this several years ago. At the University of Minnesota Medical Center, we figure that our uncompensated cost of education between the medical school and ourselves is somewhere around $50 million a year. That's after impact of state and federal money. So are there certain programs like general surgery and that have those residencies more profitable, and can they absorb more of that loss? Yes. We've tried not to, just like in our care model, we've tried not to discriminate against programs that are educational programs that are less profitable, but in general there is no profitable educational program.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question for Mr. Alexander. The veto doesn't take effect. The impact of the veto doesn't take effect until next year. And some suggest that legislators could come back then next session and find a solution to forestall this. Would you be able to wait until we found a solution next session in your planning, or would you have to begin planning now?
Representative Murphy and Mr. Chairman, great question. And actually, we both came out of our committee meetings today trying to figure out how to we are already planning because we know that there will be cuts. And as I said, we're guessing right now, but the planning is real urgent, and we're not finding any easy answers. Hence, we have to start planning now. We will have to stop filling positions to try to avoid layoffs immediately. We've already done that. As you know, other hospitals in the state have made pretty dramatic cuts in the last week, and we anticipate that we will have to start cutting very soon. So we cannot wait. The systems are so fragile that if you make radical cuts quickly, you really do harm more than just making purposeful radical cuts. So we would start right now.
And, Doctor, this will not go into effect, assuming we do nothing,
right.
This will not go into effect until July of the year after this
2010,
one.
Right.
And what are you going to have to do for planning? When do you start making decisions on
right.
what would happen if that goes into effect?
Mr. Chairman, the planning on closing programs for a year from now would start now. We would have to assure that we have a what we call a values-based approach to program cuts. And so when we do program cuts, we try to assure that the care can be provided someplace. That's number one. And in this situation, I don't think it can be. We're kind of the court of last resort for many behavioral patients. And so then we try to design models of care that will happen outside the hospital, and understand these patients are not easy. If they could be outside the hospital, they would. They're not there of their own volition frequently. So my guess is that answer will be there ain't none there. So the next question is, since we don't have an answer, we have to start getting creative now. And we do so as we have in mental health with providers and insurers and everywhere, all over. And frankly, I don't know what the answer is. I just know that we cannot afford to just keep whittling away at a program that is so fragile right now.
Other questions? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony.
Committee members, thank you very much,
wait.
Mr. Chairman.
What's on this one here? Amy Shrimp. Start of that there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amy Shrimp, and I'm a benefits counselor at the Minnesota AIDS Project, and I work directly with people living with HIV. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. We're very concerned at the Minnesota AIDS Project about what would happen if general assistance medical care is cut for people living with HIV. First, people living with HIV would go without necessary health care and treatment. In addition to that, there would be a burden on the Department of Human Services HIV/AIDS program to have those people moved on to that program if necessary. They may have to institute a waiting list, and if so, that would keep people that are HIV positive from getting necessary treatment. Also, if a person is income or asset eligible for Minnesota care, they would have a 4-month waiting period, and so that would be 4 months without getting care at all for their HIV. I also want to say that if a person goes without getting care for their HIV, they can develop a medication resistance and other serious conditions that sometimes can't be treated. And the cost to the state of Minnesota would be much higher in the emergency room as opposed to paying for primary care at the front end. Thank you again for allowing me to speak, and if you have further questions, you can contact the Minnesota AIDS Project.
Let me ask, are people with AIDS, I thought they were all eligible for SSI?
No, not necessarily. An HIV diagnosis or an AIDS diagnosis alone does not make somebody eligible for SSI. An SSI is needs-based, too, so that just kind of depends as far as how much income they have. Also, I mean, just to kind of bring up this other point, if a person is going to apply for disability and they're probably disabled, they won't be able to get medical assistance right away, and so GAMC is a way for them to get medical care while they're moving toward getting disability and medical assistance. So,
thank you. Let's see here. Bethesda Hospital. Thought I saw Kathy Bark. There she is.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, good afternoon. My name is Kathy Barr, and I'm the CEO of Bethesda Hospital, one of the state's two long-term acute care hospitals. As some of you may know, we're located right in the shadows of the state capitol building. We're just a couple hundred yards away. Because I've talked to you a couple of times before, I believe that by now you are understanding how unique our facility is. We are the specialty hospital that doctors send patients when a community hospital ICU is no longer appropriate and when a transitional care unit or a nursing home simply does not have medical care, therapies, or the technological expertise such as ventilator help for patients to continue to heal and finally go home. Our goal is to work with patients who have suffered catastrophic strokes or have been critically injured by auto accidents or have experienced multiple system failure. You talked about medical homes. These patients really aren't patients that would be medical homes. They've had a tragic event in their life, and they need help from a specialty hospital. Sometimes patients, after they've come to us and have received wonderful care and achieved high outcomes, are able to go home or even return to work. You heard that with one of our patients that came down to the hearing one day. He actually is back at work.
Ms. Barr, you should always bring him along. He's the most dynamic speaker I've heard this year.
He's wonderful, and I think he tells our story well. Bethesda Hospital treats thousands of patients each year, and they come to us not only from the Twin Cities but all over the state, from the region and the entire country. In the manner that Mayo Clinic is regarded as Minnesota's treasure for research, education, and clinical accomplishments, we actually have been told by physicians, patients, and their families that Bethesda Hospital is a Midwest destination of choice for specialized treatment and therapies, and they come to us for the services that we provide and the outcomes that they receive. Just yesterday, we had a wonderful patient example that I wish I could have brought along and showed you today, but actually, we were able to highlight that on one of the local TV news stations. I honestly wish that you could have been at Bethesda Hospital to see Bob Vesterman, who came to us last fall suffering from congestive heart failure, multiple system failure following open heart surgery, and he was finally discharged yesterday. He said he was finally free. After 7 months and many medical complications, ups and downs, he was healthy enough to finally go home. I'm proud to say that Bethesda Hospital played a very important role in that success because of the specialized care and therapies that he was able to receive. Treatment would not have been available, I do not believe, from other facilities in our area. We never gave up on Bob, and Bob never gave up on us as his caregivers and his place of choice for treatment. Through aggressive specialized care and treatment and compassionate care, Bob and his family are now together again. We've talked a lot today about the cuts. The question that we ask ourselves at Bethesda Hospital is, if these cuts are so deep, what will we need to do? At this point, we are looking at every service and asking, how can we continue this in light of the reimbursement structure? If these program eliminations take place, many patients may not be able to remain home. They won't get the specialized care and treatment. They won't have the wonderful outcomes. They'll be on a ventilator and may have to go to a nursing home or have another type of devastating outcome. If they do remain in a community hospital, this will negatively affect the community hospital's operations, as their length of stays will dramatically increase and the staffing levels will have to be adjusted for just one or two patients. Today, we have 119 patients receiving specialized care and treatment at Bethesda Hospital. We are proud that many of these patients can return home. They can lead wonderful lives with their patients and families. They can return to work. And we would hope that you would consider a more balanced approach to the budget and not one that will have such dramatic consequences to the health of our statewide community and to Bethesda, which is considered a safety net hospital. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Barr, can you estimate for us what the loss of payment would be with the veto of GMC and the loss of the DISH money?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I'm estimating about $4 million impact to us, rather significant.
And Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Murphy.
Thank you. And Ms. Barr, would you, the same question I asked the previous testifier, would you be able to hold for us to develop some sort of other mechanism next session to address what we're getting as a signal from the governor on GAMC, or would you have to start making policy changes now or coverage changes now for the people being cared for at Bethesda? How would you do your planning?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I think that that's a good question. And we would take a proactive approach. We're considering now what we'll need to do for programs and services. And I think your point is well taken about healthcare reform and that we all need to work together. I actually have talked to you somewhat in the past about our efforts at Health East on healthcare reform that I'm very proud of. We need to take a proactive approach and look at our programs and services. And I don't think that we would be reactive in nature. We'll be proactive and see what we need to do.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Bark. So, you know, I don't mean to be blunt, but can you absorb the $4 million in lost payment at Bethesda without significant changes to whom you're caring for or how you're caring for people?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I'm very concerned about that. I think that... some of the testimony that we heard earlier today is I'm unable to ring the alarm bell here in this type of forum, but I am personally able to tell you that I am extremely concerned. The impact of the $4 million is devastating to us, and it will have severe consequences. Our programs are highly specialized in nature for a specialized group of patients, and we have wonderful outcomes. And some of our programs, including the traumatic brain injury program, is a program that came out of both community need and a need that you asked us to develop a program. If we're unable to have adequate reimbursement, I do think that the programs will be impacted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
And SMDC is next. And welcome back to the committee for both of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Michael Mahoney. I'm here on behalf of Essentia Health. And with me is Kathy Von Ruden from St. Mary's Duluth Clinic Health System. And I'd like to comment today on behalf of other hospitals throughout the state of Minnesota, specifically outside the metro area. Kathy can comment specifically on SMDC, and then I'd like to focus and make a few comments on the tweener hospitals located in outstate.
Thank you very much, Chairman Huntley, members of the committee. If and when GAMC goes away, St. Mary's Duluth Clinic stands to lose over $5 million a year. For St. Mary's Medical Center, it'll be about $3.6 million, and for Miller Duana, about $1.8 million. If you look at Duluth as a whole and add in St. Luke's Hospital, which stands to lose about $2.2 million, the total is actually almost $8 million for the Duluth community. And this is just hospital reductions. This doesn't even include our clinics. As we know, the majority of this population is very difficult to manage. And at St. Mary's, over two-thirds of the GAMC patients come in through our emergency room. at St. Mary's Medical Center. Also, we receive a large percentage of the patients transferred from the smaller healthcare facilities in the region. And over 25% of the GAMC admits at St. Mary's are actually transfers from other facilities. At Miller Dwan, of the GAMC patients admitted, almost 70% of them are admitted to our inpatient mental health unit. And even though St. Mary's Duluth Clinic receives only about 28 cents on the dollar for these GA patient services, once this population is uninsured, we'll basically receive nothing. It'll all go to uncompensated care. Also, when GAMC goes away, these individuals will delay their care even further and present at our emergency room being even sicker, requiring more extensive and, of course, more expensive care, resulting in even greater losses to our facilities.
Now, Mr. Chair, just to comment, too, on the impact of the elimination of GAMC in Brainerd, St. Joseph's, St. Joseph's Medical Center in Brainerd would also experience a significant cut. Specifically, the GAMC population that they serve there, a high percentage utilizes the inpatient mental health program that they have. In Detroit Lakes, which is a 54-bed staffed facility, they too serve a high GAMC population. And so the concern for these facilities in the tweener hospitals, those hospitals that are not critical access hospitals, they're PPS hospitals, meaning that they have greater than 25 beds, but not the high volumes that the larger PPS hospitals have, they would sustain a significant hit in their communities. And so two concerns. First off, this would put in jeopardy those inpatient mental health programs that exist not only at Miller Dwan Medical Center in Duluth, but also St. Joseph's Medical Center. And secondly, if you look beyond the impact to hospitals, in Duluth alone right now, this would have a significant negative impact to the Family Practice Center, which trains physicians that ultimately end up providing primary care for in rural communities. And so that's also a very significant concern that we have. So we ask that the committee take that into consideration also in response to the governor's line item veto of GAMC.
Is there any requirement that any hospital have any certain number of mental health beds? I mean, that keeps coming up here, and obviously they lose money on mental health beds. Are there?
You know, I don't believe there is. I think we could close our unit tomorrow if we wanted to. I'd also like to comment on different program cuts or potential program cuts. As you've heard, various facilities have said they're considering that if these cuts go through. But really, we can cut all the programs we want, but these people will still show up at our emergency room, and we'll have to put them somewhere. If it's not in the mental health bed, it'll just be in one of our regular beds that we'll have to continue to treat them. So even by cutting programs back, it's not gonna be the solution.
Well, thank you for your testimony, and thank you for your trip down here.
Let's
see. We're not going to be cranky.
No.
Mike Scandrett. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name's Michael Scandrett. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition, which represents healthcare providers and organizations that provide care to uninsured and low-income and disadvantaged populations in the state. And I think you've heard of a lot of good information, so I'm going to try not to cover the things that you've heard about already. Just want to remind the committee, and I think you do understand this, that for the safety net providers, they're dealing with things that are outside of the walls of the Capitol, too, in terms of increased numbers of uninsured people who are seeking care. So they are already starting with serving more people with no additional resources for those uninsured people. We've also tried to work very closely with you on the bill that now has become law that you just passed in terms of the various cuts that are in that program to try to find ways to help you find ways to save money and to do cuts in ways that do the least damage. And I would just say thank you for your efforts to try to keep the cuts done in such a way that they don't stack up on the safety net providers by cutting death by a thousand cuts, which can happen when a lot of different line items and budgets are cut, and I appreciate that you made that effort in the bill. Unfortunately, I think we are facing a very serious problem, and people before me have talked a lot about GAMC, but there is also maybe a more urgent issue with the risk of unallotments that may occur in July. And for those of us that can remember a couple months ago, we remember what the governor's priorities were when he was deciding what things to cut when he unallotted the last time. And unfortunately, the governor chose to cut a number of line items that all are designed to keep the safety net providers in place. And the safety net providers, because they serve high proportions of people who are on public programs, a cut to those rates is a much deeper cut to their bottom line than a provider who may have 15 or 20% of their patients enrolled in public programs. And recognizing that, you have in the past developed subsidy programs such as the Federally Qualified Health Center subsidy, the Critical Access Dental subsidy, programs such as Merck and Disproportionate Share for the hospitals. And if you recall, those were the targets for the governor's unallotments in the past, and those things could begin happening in July of this year. So I don't think we can really afford to take the chance to see what would happen on that. And it is sort of a Sophie's choice that isn't really a Sophie's choice. It may appear to be a choice between eliminating GAMC and taking our chances with the unallotments, but I'm afraid that both of those things would probably happen unless we can, unless you and the governor can find a solution in the next couple of days. We can't take our chances on an allotment after session if we leave a problem that the governor feels that he has to fix. I won't go over again the GAMC cut issues. I would just say that we are about at the point where we would be turning the corner in Minnesota with these proposed cuts and the unallotments, in that for a long time we've been able to say in Minnesota, well, in Minnesota people get health care when they need it. We think it's paid for very unfairly and results in cost shifting, but at least we've been able to say people get care when they need it. And I think we are at the point where we won't be able to say that anymore, and we'll have to begin doing rationing of the worst possible kind, and that is which of the many serious health needs that people have coming into a safety net clinic are the ones that are going to get treated and which will be turned away without being able to go down the street or anywhere else to get that care. I do really appreciate that Commissioner Ludeman in his comments earlier, and I think this was really significant, did admit that this would probably result in an increase in total costs for the GAMC patients, even though it would be a decrease in the state's cost. And that's definitely true, and it makes it very clear that what the proposal does is simply shift costs to other places, and those other places can't absorb those costs, and we end up in a death spiral with rising costs and safety net providers unable to keep up with those costs. So, again, I know that you're doing the best you can, and we'll try to, over the next few days, see what solutions can be had. But I just want to urge you not to leave it to the governor to do further cuts in July, because we know that the first place he would cut would be healthcare programs and especially the safety net providers. And we would be forced at that point to not be able to say anymore that people can get health care when they need it in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions for Mr. Scandrett? Well, I would agree that this is the first time, other than Dr. Sulik in the Department of Human Services, this is the first time that I've heard somebody from the administration say that they're just shifting costs off the state budget to someplace else. Well, thank you for your testimony. And next we have the Council of Health Plans. Welcome to the committee again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Catherine Commit from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And as I testified earlier this week, we agree that the growth of the Health and Human Services budget is creating an incredible strain on the state. We also agree that we must slow the rate of increases or we'll crowd out every other budget need. However, forcing draconian cuts to a specific population of people is not the way to solve our budget deficit. These cuts will not only hurt the people on this program, but they will also have far-reaching implications to virtually every Minnesotan. This veto will have a devastating impact and further threaten our healthcare system by putting our most important safety net hospitals at risk. It will put the structural integrity of our entire healthcare system at risk, particularly in the metro area, as well as in Duluth and St. Cloud, where the majority of these individuals receive care. But the impact will not be only to the safety net hospitals. As these hospitals are forced to shut down entire programs and turn people away, the other surrounding hospitals will be forced to take on an even greater share of uncompensated and underfunded care. This is when the impact of this cut will be felt by the commercial market. Currently, 20% of commercial rates are due to cost shifts from public programs. This percentage will increase if this veto cut is allowed to go into effect. All of this will lead to an increase in the cost of health coverage, pricing even more people out of the commercial market, resulting in an even greater number of uninsured beyond those on GAMC who lose their coverage. We believe there are other ways to address this issue. And in fact, this morning, a number of organizations submitted a letter to the governor and legislature to ask the governor to be open to raising the cost of tobacco. We believe the additional revenue could be dedicated for Health and Human Services programming. We need to continue down the road of health care reform, but people need to realize that in addition to improving quality, health care reform needs to reduce the cost of health care. The health plans have a significant role in changing how health care is paid for by paying for value and not for volume. Many of my health plan members are already working on these initiatives, but providers have to redesign how care is delivered, which will have to result in a slowing of medical trend and reductions in projected revenues. This proposal shows us that if we are not successful in reforming the healthcare system, the way it will be done to the system is not desirable by anyone. Thank you.
Questions for Ms. Komet? Thank you. Let's see, what's next? Nancy Hilden and Steve Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Khaki people are here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Hilden from Fagrian Benson, and you've certainly seen us around in a few different committees this year. I'm here on behalf of the network, and thank you for the opportunity, Representative Huntley, to speak to you about this reform. I'm really just here to pass this over to Steve, and we'll hear a little bit more about this enterprise, which is really trying to do some of what I think we all want, which is to find a way to deliver services better, cheaper, successful outcomes, and that would really accomplish a lot, I think.
Yeah. We're particularly interested in how GAMC and GA and Minnesota Care might fit into your program.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And members of the committee, my name is Steve Thomas, and I'm with the Network for Better Futures, and I'm joined today not by Kevin, but by Mitchell Douglas, who is currently a GAMC recipient and a participant in the network. I'll just share a few remarks, and then Mitchell would like to offer his perspective. But as for those who don't know, the network is a demonstration out to prove that we can get much better results from a group of high-risk adults and not only reduce state spending, but to also create jobs and achieve much better results for these group of high-risk adults. GAMC is a cornerstone feature of our endeavor. Every man enrolled into the network, and that's been over 250 men since January 2008, almost always initially start out on GAMC. I'll talk more about that in a minute, but first, the high-risk adults that we're enrolling are, by definition, have to be homeless, have a history of chronic unemployment and of using state institutional care that typically is jail, prison, treatment programs, and they have a history of mental illness and a history of substance abuse. So we actively enroll those men, and upon enrollment, they provide access to receive access to housing, a rent subsidy, work if they need it, and what we're talking about today, health insurance. That health insurance provides access to primary health care and behavioral health services and a community experience. During our first 12 months, we enrolled 224 of these high-risk men, and 136 actually came out of prison when they enrolled with us. As I said, all the men enrolled with GA received health insurance under GAMC, and the effect of that insurance was the following. First, it provided access to primary health care. Every man within the first 10 days gets a full physical. And I don't need to tell you, this committee is much more experienced than I am, but the group of people we're enrolling, mostly African-American men, Native American men, are some of the highest risk groups in the state in terms of health care, and they're also some of the lowest participants in the primary health care system. So we're providing them access to that health care system through the means by the means of GAMC. Secondly, upon enrollment, every enrollee receives a behavioral health assessment, of which the health plans pay for. They welcome it, because among this population, there's the numbers are that 25% of the state prison population is on psychotropic medications. The number of people in coming out of prison with serious mental illness is much higher than that. About 30% of our men are suffering with some form of serious mental illness. So this behavioral health assessment is not only critical, it provides access to some of the ongoing treatment and counseling and therapy that are needed. And the other thing that the insurance provides, and I want to make an important point here, unlike some of the other folks who spoke, this is a stepping stone to something longer term and more sustainable in the private sector. So the GAMC Care is a stepping stone to, over time, a full-time job with benefits, including healthcare benefits in the private sector. But this insurance and the access to the critical services it provides has led to some pretty significant outcomes. And again, not just in the healthcare arena, of which now the men we're serving are being treated for diabetes in a proper way. They're being treated for a variety of chronic or untreated health conditions that they weren't being treated for. And then the access to the mental health system's been very powerful for us. But there's also been results on the other side. All of our men are working. And in the past, without access to this health care and this behavioral health care, those were the very reasons why they lost their jobs in the past. The other thing is we have significant public safety outcomes. We have lower return to prison rates, lower arrest rates, and lower new conviction rates. And that is in part the result of having access to the behavioral health and the chemical health care that is needed, because often the primary reason for going back for most of our men are release violations, and those are related to substance abuse or mental health issues. And another outcome, as I said, not only are all our men working, but they're earning a wage and paying child support. So there's increased child support payments coming back to the state. So without this critical public and social asset for our endeavor, we intentionally from the beginning designed it around having the availability of health insurance. Without that availability, our ability to keep the men in decent housing, to keep them in work, and to keep them out of the criminal justice system would be significantly impaired. With that, I just would like Mitchell to offer a few words since he's actually benefiting from GAMC right now.
How you doing?
Welcome to the committee.
My name is Mitchell Douglas. Basically, it's like this. I think healthcare assistance and whatnot is the cornerstone of everything that happens there to follow. Coming out of prison like I did a month and a half ago, it was like a starting point for me. And having healthcare and having the assistance to go and get a physical and eye exam and so on, dental, it gave me a starting point. You know, it gave me the willingness to go on. I never took health seriously growing up. It was like an afterthought. And just having it there to grab hold of it and look at it on a positive level as far as what I need and am I able to work, am I willing to work, and so on, it was a good thing. You know, I never looked at healthcare as being a long-term effect for me. I know medical assistance is just short-term because I want to do bigger and better as far as, you know, getting a job, getting the right insurance for me and, you know, contributing to my community. You know, I took so much from the community. I want to give back a lot. And I think that's the cornerstone of everything. And it's valuable to us, healthcare, you know, assisting as far as guys coming out, like Steve said, mental health and things of that nature. I think I'll just be granted that I got a good health and I got a good mind on my shoulder and I can do better things. And it's just the cornerstone of everything that follows, you know. DOC, that gives you so much, but to get a second opinion out here in the free world, you could say. And I mean, doctors is doctors, but I think out here is real doctors. And I think just being healthy and just being able to contribute to the community and getting that cornerstone of health, you know, assisting and whatnot is a great thing. And I think we need it in this organization to keep it going. With that, I'll pass.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Any questions?
Not so much a question, Mr. Chairman, it's just to thank you, and especially you, Mitchell. It really means a lot to, you know, see the real people who are affected by the cut that's before us. And so I want to thank you for your testimony and also thank the network for the good work you're doing.
Yeah, I'd also like to thank you for testifying. And I think I said earlier, one of the things that got me this year was somebody said, you can't have a medical home unless you have a home, and which is precisely what this organization does, is provide these folks with a home while they're getting back into our society. So,
Mr. Chair, if yeah. I may, I know you're pressed. Just two thoughts. You know, they release nearly 3,000 people a year. We do, from prison. And most of these folks are indigent and need this kind of care to make the transition. We have the capacity right now to only serve about 120 of those high-risk adults. We're hoping, we passed around with some additional federal stimulus money, that we can enroll close to 300 more. But I think this is the kind of thinking we need in the future, that an investment in GAMC helps an enterprise like this serve high-risk people that brings multiple benefits to multiple parts of the state budget. So we appreciate your fight to keep this alive. And
okay, thank you very much. And
thank you.
Kathy Tomlin.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Clark.
I just thought maybe the audience might like to know, too, that we're under the call of the House, and that's why you see some of it. And maybe the Senate is, too, under the call. That's why we're leaving. It's not because we don't want to hear what you have to say, and it'll all be recorded. So please know that even though we have to go on, I'm really grateful for the chairman's being here.
Yeah, well, this is a strange time of the year for to try to schedule anything, because we never know what's going to happen.
Well, Chairman Huntley, my name is Kathy Tomlin from Catholic Charities Office for Social Justice. Thank you for holding this hearing, because I think this is a very important piece of information that we got kind of thrown at us today. You know, right down the block here is the Dorothy Day Center. Right now we have 250 people sleeping on the floor an inch apart. It was set up to be a drop-in center. It is now a homeless shelter for 250 people. 50 of those people are on general assistance medical care. And it was Catholic Charities' vision that we were going to be emptying out these shelters, not adding more people to them, which is why we started a program called Housing First, which was to get people who had been long-term homeless, that is 10 to 12 years homeless in the community, in housing and stabilized. And we have a hugely successful program. We have 5 people now doing that. But of the people in our housing program, about 300 of them are on general assistance medical care. The ones that have been part of the Housing First program, right now, 100 of those people are in general assistance medical care. And so it's really important to us to see the connections between housing stabilization and health care. These folks are finally stabilized. They're getting the support services. They're taking their medication. And we know from our own kind of anecdotal information that the people in our shelters, 60 to 70% of them, come in with some form of mental illness. So GAMC is critical to the success, not only of health care, but for housing stability for the people that Catholic Charities serves. And as we've been talking about the implications for health care facilities and the health care of people, I think we need to think about the dignity of each person being able to make a decision involving their own health and not having it be left up to maybe some fund, maybe somewhere that some hospital may be able to access in order to get care. So being able to make those decisions up front and take care of yourself is really important. And I know from talking to people at St. Mary's Health Clinics that are the free clinics in the metro area, the thought of having 30,000 more people at their door is daunting, to say the least. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for your long wait. And my apologies for people moving in and out, but
it's understandable.
It's the way it has to be. Yes, so thank you very much, and the meeting is adjourned.